Today we're going to talk about one of those forbidden subjects, Chuck.
And we have a very special guest with us that we're quite excited about. Dennis Cuddy is with us. He received a Ph.D. from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and he taught in the public school system and at the university level. He also was a political risk analyst for an international consulting firm. He authored and edited 4 books on American foreign relations and immigration. He's authored numerous articles, and he served as a senior associate with the U.S. Department of Education in Washington, D.C. And, John, he's really your friend. Why don't you take it from here?
Well, he's also author of 2 what I call very important small books, The Road to Socialism and The New World Order, and Secret Records Revealed, The Men, The Money, and The Methods Behind the New World Order. You'll see Dr. Cuddy's editorials in USA Today from time to time, usually in a point of rebuttal against some socialist mainline propaganda. But anyway, welcome to the show, Dr. Cuddy.
Thank you for having me.
The term New World Order, quite frequently, Dennis, we hear this as being a product of, say, downstream from the Protocols of Zion, that long-debunked anti-Semitic document that some right-wing groups use. But the term New World Order didn't really originate on the right, did it?
No, and let me digress, but it's important. There's an effort among, I guess, C. Wright Mills used to call them the power elite. And C. Wright Mills, of course, is not a conservative at all. He's, in fact, he was something of a socialist. His book is read widely in university reading classes for their courses. And what you have generally is a counter argument that goes on, sometimes a preemptive strike, actually. When the controversy over humanism came up, you would find the mainline media saying, oh, well, no one knows what it is. It's somewhere obscure. It's just a few people, if there is anything. And anybody who took the time just to take a basic look could find out that the International Humanist and Ethical Union had 4 million members, and they had volumes out explaining how they were going to undermine the public schools and undermine Christianity. Mainstream media paid any attention. Same thing with the New World Order. Whenever you bring that topic up, they'll start talking about, oh, this is some kind of crazy conspiracy theory, like McCarthyism, seeing commies behind every tree and so on. But what I try to do is go to the sources themselves. For example, on the issue of McCarthyism, I go to Carl Bernstein of Wardwood and Bernstein fame, Watergate,
right.
In his book, Loyalties, A Son's Memoirs, where it's a conversation between his parents and himself, who, and his parents were members of the Communist Party here, and his father especially was saying, I'm worried, Carl, about this book you're going to write because you're going to clean McCarthy up. People said McCarthy is a liar, but he was not. He was actually correct. We were a force in the country. And he goes on, in essence, they had duped the mainline media. Of course, they were primarily willing to be duped at the time. Now we have revelations from the Venona documents and others that actually there was a communist element in high positions in the government. So what I try to do is use those types of sources. Carl Bernstein, for example, has a very high reputation among the power elite and the mainstream media. So when I talk about the New World Order, I will try to use quotes from Woodrow Wilson, Franklin Roosevelt, and go to the people's diaries, their private papers. For example, Woodrow Wilson's chief advisor was Colonel Edward Mandel House, who covertly wrote a book called Philip Drew Administrator, describing socialism as dreamed of by Karl Marx, and that's what they wanted. Franklin Lane, one of the secretaries under Wilson, said everything in Philip Drew was coming to pass under Woodrow Wilson. The point of this is Colonel House was in his diary. There's only about 3 copies of this, I think, in existence. It's never been published, and I got one of them. Is explaining in his diary in 1919, looking backwards, that Clemenceau and Orlando from France and Italy, the premiers, were very concerned about these Bolsheviks and their revolution. And they wanted to see if they could stop it militarily. And in this diary, House is saying how he convinced Clemenceau, Orlando, and even his own president, Wilson, that they could not do this. And then he confides in his diary, of course, I knew that we could. Only a small armament of small tanks and voluntary mercenaries could have put this down. So, in effect, you have one person changing the entire course of history. If you think about the millions of people slaughtered under the Bolsheviks, the nuclear holocaust that was hanging over our head for decade after decade, So when you go to these people's private diaries, papers, and use reputable sources, it's very clear that there is this new world order that's been going along for a long time.
Where do you see the term first really being used, the new world order? It's become such a buzzword today. How did that evolve?
Well, it comes in various forms. Some people say Novus Ordo Seclorum on the dollar bill at the time meant that, and it does in a way. New World Order goes back to, I guess the most famous book is H.G. Wells, who was a Fabian socialist and had broken with the other Fabians because he wanted this out in the open. He wrote a book called The Open Conspiracy Blueprint for World Revolution. He authored in 1939 a book by the title The New World Order, which he mapped out and showed how it would come about. It would be a synthesis between Eastern communism and Western capitalism into a world socialism. But prior to that, you would have people like Wilson, I believe, delivered a speech in Minneapolis in 1919.
Talking about Woodrow Wilson, right?
Right, Woodrow Wilson, where he was talking about the order of the new world. They would use those terms, but not necessarily in that order. You had books titled The New World Order even prior to Wells. There was one by a man named Samuel Zane Batten from the American Baptist Society of all places, saying we need this world socialism. That was 1919. So there are books by the title The New World Order going back at least that far. Then the concept, of course, goes back to in the last century, the 1800s, Edward Bellamy's book and some other books generally talk about that sort of thing. You have the general concept going far back. The Baha'is, Baha'u'llah in the last century around 1850 was talking about the need for a world government. The first I can tell major person was Dante in 1313 AD in his book De Monarchia, claiming that we needed a government for the world, a world government. So the concept of world government goes far back. The actual use of the term New World Order in terms of a book title goes back to at least 1919, and then the concept even before that.
Now, we see I think it was in 34, when we see the occultic overtones introduced also through Alice Bailey, didn't we?
Right. Her, going back into the previous century, Madame Blavatsky had been part of the revolutionary element that had come up after the French Revolution and the League of the Just with Karl Marx and so on. And she had joined Garibaldi in the middle of the last century and formed the Theosophical Society. And after her was Annie Besant took over. And then after her, Alice Bailey, whose books were first published around 1921 with Lucifer Publishing Company.
Which is now called Lucis Trust.
Right. And next year they changed their name to Lucis Trust. And they used to be housed up at the UN, the UN Plaza. They moved down the street now on Wall Street, I believe. But they would supervise to some extent the UN meditation room and so on. But anyway, in the 20s, Alice came up with a new group of world servers, the Arcane School, World Goodwill, and so forth. And in the 30s, she started writing supposedly from these ascended masters. She was getting these telecommunications or whatever, where she would say, we need a new world order with points of light connected to service, if you've heard that phrase recently.
That was George Bush, right?
President Bush, yeah. But that's what fascinates me from just a whole other angle is the intertangling of channeling demons, whatever, fascinates me from a theological point of view.
It seemed that Alice Bailey had a plan for education. Now, as I recall, Robert Mueller has sort of given credit to Alice Bailey and Joal Cole. Joal Cole was the demon spirit that she channeled for his World Core curriculum, which is being used in education today.
Yes, she has a number of books. One was Initiation, Human and Solar, and she gets into some, as you indicated, some very occult things. And she also had a volume published, Education in the New Age. She would talk about we need the New Age. And she would spell that out. And H.G. Wells did some similar things with education, how that would be one of their forces for developing this world socialist government. And Robert Mueller, of course, being ever since the 1950s an assistant secretary at the UN, probably was familiar with a lot of this. And so when he developed his World Core curriculum that they have put into what's called the Robert Mueller School, it's down in Arlington, Texas, it says in the introduction of that that it's based on the underlying principles of Alice Bailey, which would be from that Joao Cool Ascended Master, supposedly.
Okay. One of the most fascinating quotes in Dr. Cuddy's research has been from Carol Quigley's book. Now, Carol Quigley was Bill Clinton's mentor at Georgetown University. And as I recall, Dennis, President Clinton twice now has paid public homage to Professor Quigley for the influence that the professor had on his life. Is that correct?
Yes, and he's delivered a speech at Georgetown prior to his election, and then during his acceptance speech at the Democratic nomination in 92 when he was elected, he singled Quigley out as a great influence on what he'd done. He actually, I found out from the biographer, or one of them, of Bill Clinton's, that the president still has the copy of A Tragedy and Hope on his bookshelf where he lives.
Okay, but Chuck, yeah. You've got to read this quote.
Yes,
this
quote from the book really sort of gives you an insight. There's so many people, Christian and pseudo-Christian authors and ministries, that are making such an emotional thing about Christians even being aware of these tides and trends, and that's one reason we're trying to focus on this with our guest. But reading from Clinton's mentor, Professor Quigley, it reads as follows, for example. There does exist, and has existed for a generation, an international network which operates to some extent in the way the radical right believes communists act. In fact, this network, which we may identify as the Roundtable Groups, has no aversion to cooperating with the communists or any other groups, and frequently does so. I know of the operations of this network because I've studied it for 20 years and was permitted for 2 years in the early 60s to examine its papers and secret records. I have no aversion to it to most of its aims, and have for much of my life been close to it and to many of its instruments. I have objected both in the past and recently to a few of its policies, but in general my chief difference of opinion is that it wishes to remain unknown, and I believe its role in history is significant enough to be known, close quote.
I guess by Roundtable Group, Dennis, he's talking about the Council on Foreign Relations, am I correct?
You're basically right, but I'll give you the 30-second history of this thing.
Okay.
Cecil Rhodes, who formed the Rhodes Scholars, Rhodes Scholarships, of which Bill Clinton and Strobe Talbott and others were nominated and selected, formed a secret society called the Society of the Elect. It had a circle of initiates and so forth. The Association of Helpers were formed after Rhodes' death by Lord Alfred Milner, and they formed the Round Table Groups, which were semi-secret organizations, from which in England came the Royal Institute of International Affairs, and in this country, the Council on Foreign Relations.
Which was originally the Institute on Foreign Affairs, but they just changed the name. Which Mandel House was involved as well, Colonel House.
Right. Colonel Edward Mandel House was the leading force in setting that up in 1921.
That was almost 10 years after he'd set up the Federal Reserve Bank in 1913.
Right, 1913, so. Which was a key element. And that, too, was something of a, quote, conspiracy, according to one of the members involved in it.
Because they met in secret on Jekyll Island. It was politicians and bankers who met to do this, right?
Right. Frank Vanderlip was one of the few people who were on that car in the box car that went down to Jekyll Island. He said they couldn't use their names. They had to have code names. They couldn't be seen with each other. And he wrote this up in 1935 in the Saturday Evening Post, saying he'd never felt more like a conspirator in his life.
Can you give us, we've been talking about history a little, can you give us some feeling of more modern, more recent events like NAFTA, GATT, and so forth that are consistent with this whole tide and trend?
Right. In the little booklet, Secret Records Revealed, I try to track this through because many people, whenever you talk about the Council on Foreign Relations, are very skeptical. They say, well, this is some sort of right-wing conspiracy theory. But Quigley would refer in that book that you were quoting from that the CFR was a, quote, front organization for the power elite. Not only that, the year before Quigley's book, Arthur Schlesinger, a very famous historian and with the Kennedy administration in his book, A Thousand Days, said the same thing. And he's a member. He said the CFR is a front for the power elite, along with the Rockefeller, Ford, and Carnegie foundations. He called them fronts. So they're very bold about that. And the Rhodes Scholars, there are many of them in the Clinton administration. One is Richard Gardner, who back in the Council on Foreign Relations Journal, which is called Foreign Affairs in April of 74, would say that to get to our House of World Order, it would be better to erode national sovereignty piece by piece than the old-fashioned frontal attack. And then he went on and explained how they would use GATT to do that. And this is 1974, about almost 23 or so years ago. And so the plan had been in the works for quite some time. The idea being, if you develop regional economic arrangements. Again, part of Cecil Rhodes' Association of Helpers back in the 1940s, a fellow named Corbett would write about this. You have to develop regionalism first, regional economic entities first, before you can then have a world economy, and then you will say that when it was a step-by-step strategy, which has been going on for many, many decades. The plan has been laid out, and NAFTA and GATT are tremendous parts of it, because then what you do is you shift people's loyalties from their nation to their economic interest, which may lie in these, let's say, NAFTA, and then APEC and the Asian Pacific and the European Community. And therefore, in terms of socialism, you would find the phrase applicable, workers of the world unite. We become workers. And you find the schools today going into the outcome-based education, school to work, because they're preparing students, you'll hear this phrase, to compete in the global economy.
Right.
So you transfer people's thought processes to this global development that's going on, and therefore they're no longer seen as extremely loyal to their nation.
We even saw this, I think, manifested in the State of the Union address recently, where President Clinton, throughout that speech, speaks of global this and global that. And that's one reason we wanted to sort of bring all this out for our listeners, is because there is a view being promoted that somehow an awareness of these things suggests that you're some kind of extreme right conspiracy buff, when in fact it's just one of being aware of a manifest tide that's even using just the writings of the left, not the right, to understand what the agenda is and what its manifest destiny would appear to be. Is that fair, John?
I would say so. Dennis, you know, we've got about 2.5 minutes left. Why don't you tell us about Strobe Talbott? This one's sort of unique.
Well, Strobe Talbott is a Rhodes Scholar roommate of Bill Clinton, who wrote in the summer prior to Clinton's first election that perhaps national sovereignty is not such a great idea after all, and that the case for world government is clinched. He wrote that in Time magazine. And after that, he received a Global Governance Award from the World Federalist Association. And President Clinton wrote a congratulatory letter to the WFA saying that he thought this was a fine selection of Strobe Talbott, and Clinton noted that their previous president, Norman Cousins, had worked for world peace and world government. I mean, he specifically used that term, and he concluded the letter by wishing this organization, quote, future success. Their sole reason for existence is to have a world federal government. So we have this support. Another Rhodes Scholar, Robert Reich, to pick up on what Chuck said, wrote in a book, I don't know what an American company is anymore. You're all primarily multinationals. So I try to use their own words to demonstrate what we're talking about.
That's an interesting example you use, because I used to be a senior executive with Ford Motor Company, One American Road, Dearborn, Michigan. I left Ford at the end of the 68-69 time period. And when I left the Ford Motor Company, over half their assets were outside the United States. In other words, these multinational corporations aren't just exporters, importers. They're ones that legally, structurally straddle borders. And I think that's another dimension to all of this. But another word's come up here, John, that you mentioned very briefly. You notice the word has shifted from New World Order to global governance.
Right.
You mentioned that, but I'd like to really emphasize that for our listeners, that the buzzwords are shifting. And can you comment on that, John?
Well, New World Order became a liability. I think what surprised everybody, President Bush first began to say New World Order. Most people in the public said, what's a New World Order? For those of us who've been following the history of it, we fell off our chair because he was using it in public. Not only was he doing that, he was quoting from Alice A. Bailey, whom is a known occultist. So this set up red flags real quick, and a lot of us were quick to jump on that. So it became a liability within about 2 years. And now the slide is to global governance. And you notice how it's a slight twist, Dennis, and I'm sure you could elaborate on this, the fact that they will say, well, we're not doing global governance. We have global governance. Well, how do you have governance without some kind of legal structure intact? And that's ultimately what we're talking about at these United Nations summits now.
Trying to soften it with the idea of a federated collection of nations and that sort of thing.
It's like Dr. Cuddy said, we talk about the thing, we have to be prepared to compete in the coming century. Clinton is now repeating this mantra over and over again. You'll hear other mantras in education, such as the school to work, you know, lifelong learning. That's the next buzzword you'll hear. And it sounds good, but it doesn't mean that. Speaking of education, Chuck, there are three prongs to this whole New World Order we're talking about.
Yeah, exactly. We generally see three three legs on a stool, one being political, one being religious, and one being education. We've talked a lot about the political thing, broadly speaking, but let's focus a little on the education side of this thing. Let me pass the ball to you, Dennis.
Okay. Previously, I mentioned Cecil Rhodes. The idea in his particular plan, now there were others, there are the Fabian Socialists, and that's a whole other track, but was to have key people within about 3 or 4 decades penetrate the areas of politics, economics, journalism, and education. And the idea would be they would credential individuals who would then become published heads of universities, and they in turn would open doors to the right type of people, namely globalists, that they wanted to in key positions. You would find that in terms of American education specifically, John Dewey had been head of what's called the League for Industrial Democracy. Previously, it had been titled Intercollegiate Socialist Society. And during the 1920s and 30s, they moved very quickly and talked boldly about collectivizing America. Laissez-faire capitalism would have to go. We need to develop a new social order. And it hooked in with religion as well, because Dewey was a co-author of the first Humanist Manifesto in 1933. What they were trying to do is shift from the cognitive, academic basics, reading, writing, math, to the social areas, affective, social relationships, because that's important to socialism, the group rather than the individual. In today's terms, you have cooperative learning under outcome-based education, so they're pushing this along. They had gotten pretty much control of Teachers College at Columbia University and several other key schools. They would set up what was called the Educational Trust in 1915. Shortly after that, the head of the NEA, George Strayer, would say, give them the axe if they don't do what we want them to. And they had developed a real network so that they had placement barons to be sure that their type of people were in key positions. And they had, by the 50s and 60s, gotten control right down to the school level, so that from the cognitive to the affective,
right.
Social promotion started coming, grade inflation, discipline moved into the 30s and into the 70s into what the humanist Sidney Hook called a battle of indirection, getting students to have critical thinking, so they would question their religion, their parents, and so forth. And so in the 80s, one of the founders of the four million member group, H.J. Blackham, said if the schools teach dependence, moral dependence in other ways, on oneself, they are, quote, more revolutionary than any conspiracy to overthrow the government. And that's what they did. They made a generation gap so that the students looked at themselves as autonomous moral decision makers. And that's why you see this rise in juvenile crime today.
Interesting. Could you just elaborate on the three planks to education, the parents as teachers, the goals 2000, OBE, and the lifelong learning? Can you elaborate on that as a pattern?
Well, parents as teachers is at the earliest stage, where you supposedly voluntarily ask a parent educator, usually at first an older person, but then they will give you younger people, who will come in and, in effect, monitor how you're raising your children. They actually have a checklist. Do you give enough time to your child? I have this checklist aside here, but it's a really rather intrusive into your privacy of your home checklist. They're getting away with it now by means of voluntarism, but one of the textbooks they used was Arthur Calhoun's The History of the American Family. It's a large social service textbook back in 1919. In there, and he was saying how in the future, under socialism, children would be turned more and more over to these community experts. And he elaborated on that. And Parents as Teachers is that type of program, and it's actually part of Goals 2000, which followed up with President Bush's America 2000. And Goals 2000 really is a movement towards nationalizing education. In fact, President Clinton, in his State of the Union just a few days ago, said we need to have high national education standards. You need to adjust your curriculum to reflect those standards. And he said he, over the next 2 years, would lead in the development of national tests. It's this movement towards nationalizing things, which gets you towards socialism. National education, national health care, national police force, national service. Recently, President Clinton and George Bush and Colin Powell got together and wanted to emphasize national service again. It's this tendency towards nationalizing which is necessary as a phase toward internationalizing. They're already having international standards in education.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
And lifelong learning is their vehicle to keep track of you over time. Mark Tucker, for example, with a Carnegie outfit, said to Hillary Clinton, a board member, that he'd just come out of David Rockefeller's office, and they were celebrating Bill Clinton's victory because it would give them a chance to put in place their human resource management system, monitoring people, students, everybody, from cradle to grave, the same system for everyone. And so lifelong learning allows them to say, well, we need to track you throughout your whole life.
Right, and we're talking about...
It's a school-to-work thing.
It's a school-to-work thing, right. And we're not just talking about academic performance. It's a good 50% of it, it's psychological profiling, am I correct?
School-to-work is your skills development, your capability of working with others, and to that extent it gets into your psychology. Part of what the educators did was the Psychological Corporation was set up in 1920, and in there's an article written shortly thereafter by its founder saying we want to get key people in key places psychologically who are adjusted towards our way of thinking. And later on, I got the private correspondence that they had between themselves and the first governor's school in the nation that I happened to attend back in 63, and they said we want to keep files on these people, you know, monitor, track, and so forth. It's this grand experiment which goes through Tavistock in England and the National Training Labs, which was set up by the NEA in 1947 and later produced a book called Issues in Human Relations Training, where it refers to their sensitivity training as, quote, brainwashing, quote. So there's a whole pattern here.
This is the end of Side 1. Please turn your cassette over at this time for the continuation of this message.